What he was doing was cross-testing the consecutive loads on the belt for uranium. The fans beat a fog of ore particles into the air at this point in the progressive steps. It was Johnny's job to throw a lever that sent beams through the whirlwind, check the panel to see whether a purple or a red light went on, and throw levers that sent the ore on for transshipment, purple, or dumped it to the side and sounded an alarm, red. When the red came on, it was urgent to dump. He was not operating independently. He was closely supervised by Kerr, the assistant operations officer of the mine site. Kerr was protected by domed headgear. Johnny was catching the hurricane of dust and din full in the eyes and face. He did not even have goggles. Kerr walloped him on the shoulder to indicate that this bucketful could be sent on, and Johnny thrust at the levers. Kerr had been carefully chosen by the security chief as the very fellow to instruct the animal in the operation of mine site machinery, and Turl had his reasons. A midget for a cyclo, Kerr was only 7 feet tall. He was a geyser mouth, as they called it, since he chattered incessantly. Nobody bothered to listen to him. He had no friends, but tried to make them. He was reputedly dim-witted, even though he knew his machines well. If these reasons were not enough, Turl had leverage. He had caught Kerr in a compromising situation involving two female cyclo clerks in an out-of-bounds operations office. Turl had picto-recorded, but not reported it, and Kerr and the females had been very grateful. There were other things. Kerr was a habitual criminal who had taken employment on Earth one jump ahead of arrest, and Turl had fixed up a name change. Before the animal idea had occurred to Turl, he had tried to work out something involving Kerr, but it would have been impossible for a cyclo to go into those mountains, and he had been forced to abandon taking Kerr into his confidence. But Kerr had his uses. He was chattering away now, voice dimmed by the helmet he wore and by the din.
You have to be sure to detect every scrap of radiation dust. Not one isotope must get through to the platform.
What would it cause? Shouted Johnny.
There'd be a spark flash on the home planet, like I told you. The teleportation platform there would get disrupted, and we'd catch blazes. It's just the dust. You have to make sure there's none in the dust. No uranium.
Has it ever happened? Shouted Johnny.
Blast no, roared Kerr. And it never will.
Just dust? Said Johnny.
Just dust.
What about a solid piece of uranium?
You won't detect that.
Would anything detect it?
We never ship it.
They got along pretty well. At first, Kerr had thought the animal was a peculiar thing. But it seemed friendly, and Kerr didn't have any friends. And the animal asked questions constantly, and Kerr loved to talk. Better an animal audience than none at all. Besides, it was a favor to Turl and staved off possible disclosures. Turl brought the man-thing down each morning, tied it up to the machine it would operate, and picked it up each night. Kerr, much cautioned and threatened with the consequences if Johnny got loose, had the right to untie the animal and put it on another machine. The regular operator this morning was glad of a break. The post was extremely dangerous and had killed several cyclos in past decades. One usually got danger pay for it, but that was now suspended with the economy wave. The freighter load was handled. The last bucketful went by on the conveyor belt position, and the whole area drifted down to momentary idleness. The regular operator came back, looking suspiciously at his equipment.
Did it break anything?
Said the regular operator with a talon jerk at Johnny.
It hasn't broken anything around here yet, said Kerr defensively.
I heard it blew up a blade scraper.
Oh, that scraper was one that had already blown up, said Kerr. You know, the one a few months ago that got Whaler.
Oh, that one. The one that got a hairline crack in its canopy?
Yeah, said Kerr, that one.
I thought this animal blew it up.
That's just that Zit's making excuses for lack of maintenance.
Nevertheless, the regular operator carefully checked over his uranium detection station.
Why are you so nervous about it? Said Johnny.
Hey,
said the regular operator. It talks cyclo.
He could have had a leak in his helmet, explained Care to Johnny, or you could have left some dust on the controls.
Johnny looked up at the regular operator. You ever have a helmet blow up?
Blazes no. I'm still alive, ain't I? And I ain't gonna have any breathe gas blow up around me. Get off my machine. Another freighter is coming in.
Care untied the animal and led it over to the shade of a power pylon.
That about completes you on the transshipment machinery. Tomorrow, I'm gonna start you on actual mining.
Johnny looked around. What's that little house over there? Care looked. It was a small domed structure with a bunch of cooling coils on the back of it.
Oh, the morgue. Company orders require all dead cyclos to get returned to home planet.
Johnny was interested. Sentiment? Families?
Oh, no. Blazes, no. Nothing silly like that. They got some dumb idea that if an alien race had dead cyclos to fool around with, they could work out the metabolism and get up to mischief. Also, it's a sort of nose count. They don't want names riding on a payroll after a guy's dead. Somebody else could collect the pay. It used to be done.
What happens with them? The corpses?
Oh, we let them collect and then schedule their teleportation back, just like any other package. When they get home, they bury them. The company has its own cemetery on Cyclo.
Must be quite a planet. Care glowed with a smile.
You can say that. None of these damned helmets are canopies. Unlimited breathe gas. The whole atmosphere is breathe gas. Wonderful. Good gravity. Not thin like this. Everything a gorgeous purple. And females aplenty. When I get out of here, maybe, if Trill fixes it so I can, I'm going to have 10 wives and just sit all day chomping kerbango and rolling the females.
Don't they have to import all the breathe gas here?
Yes, indeed. You can't make it on other planets. It takes certain elements that seldom exist off Cyclo.
I should think the home planet would run out of atmosphere.
Oh, no, said Care. The elements are in the rocks and even the core, and it just makes more and more. See those drums over there?
Johnny looked at a pyramid of drums that had evidently just come in on reverse teleportation from Cyclo. Trucks with lifts were loading them. And just as he looked, a truck was shifting some barrels aboard the last freighter in.
Those drums are going back overseas, said Care.
How many mine sites are there? Said Johnny. Care scratched where his dome met his collar.
16, I think.
Where are they located? Said Johnny, being very casual. Care started to shrug and then had a happy thought. He reached into a rear pocket and brought out a sheaf of papers. He had used the back of a map to make some work assignment notes on. He unfolded it. Although it was covered with creases and dirt, it was quite plain. It was the first time Johnny had seen a map of the whole planet. With a searching talon, Care counted.
Yep, 16 with 2 substations. That's the lot.
What's a substation? Care pointed up at the pylon. Other pylons marched southwest into the distance until they were dwindling specks.
That power line comes in from a hydroelectric installation several 100 miles from here. It's an ancient dam. The company changed all the machinery in it, and it gives us all our power here for transshipment. It's a substation.
Any workers there?
Oh, no. All automatic. There's another substation on the overseas south continent. It's not manned either.
Johnny looked at the map. He was excited, but showed none of it. He counted 5 continents. Every mine site was precisely marked. He reached over and took a pen out of Care's breast pocket. How many machines do I still have to be checked out on? Asked Johnny. Care thought about it.
There's drillers, hoists.
Johnny reached over and took the map and folded it so there was a fresh blank space on the back. He began to list the machines as Care called them out. When the list was finished, Johnny gave Care his pen but casually put the map in his pouch. Johnny stood up and stretched. He hunkered back down and said, "Tell me some more about Cyclo. Sure must be an interesting place."
The assistant operations officer chattered on. Johnny listened intently. The data was a valuable flood, and the map in his pouch crackled comfortingly. When just one man was taking on the whole empire of the Cyclos in the hope of freeing his people, every scrap of information had value beyond price. The engulfing roar of company operations thundered around them in enormous power. Chapter 5 1 Eyes on the sky of an evening, noting the slow yearly wheel of the constellations, Johnny knew he would have to escape. In about 3 weeks, the year would be up. He had a horrible vision of Chrissy coming into the plains and, if she survived there, blundering onto the mine site. There were many obstacles. It would be almost insurmountably difficult, given the search tools of the Cyclos. But he set about planning his road to freedom with stubborn relentlessness. Complicating his plans was the self-set goal of an Earth free of Cyclos and the resurrection of the human race. Lying awake, he saw the cage revealed in all its ugliness by a rising moon, and he almost ridiculed himself for his own timidity. Here he was, collared like a dog, chained up, locked behind bars, subject to swift detection and swifter pursuit. Yet he knew that even if he died trying, he would more than try. First, he must escape. A key to possible freedom came to him only 2 days later. Freedom at last from his collar. For some reason, Turl had insisted that he be trained in electronic repair. The explanation Turl gave was thin. Sometimes the controls of a machine broke, sometimes the remote control systems went awry, and the operator had to handle it. That Turl had done the explaining was enough to disqualify the reason. But more than that, in all the time Johnny had been training on machines, he had never seen an operator touch electronic repair. When something went wrong, somebody came screeching in on a tri-wheeled cart from the electronics section and fixed it fast. That Turl insisted that Johnny know how to do it, Care had not objected for an instant, was one more piece of the puzzle that was Turl. Whatever Turl wanted of him eventually would happen somewhere where there were no electronics repairmen. So Johnny sat, dwarfed on a bench, learning circuits and diagrams and components. They didn't give him too much trouble. The electrons went here, got changed there, and wound up doing something else over at this place. The little wires and components and pieces of binding metal all made pretty good sense. It was the tools that mystified him at first. There was a thing like a little knife that had a big handle. Big to Johnny, small to a Cyclo, that did the most remarkable thing. When you turned a switch to the proper number in its heel and put the blade down on a piece of wire, the wire fell apart. And when you reversed it and touched it to the wires you were now holding together, they became one piece once more. It only happened when you were splitting or binding the same type of metal. You had to use a binding substance when handling two different types of metal that you wanted to join. When Care wandered off for one of his frequent snacks, and Johnny was tied up alone for the moment in the electronics shop, he tested the tool against the frayed end of the leash. It came apart, cleanly cut. Johnny reversed the switch, held the cut pieces together, and touched the tool to it. They went back together with no trace of the cut. Johnny knew without trying it that it would do the same thing to his metal collar. He looked at the door to make sure Care was not coming back and no one else coming in, and then he swept his eyes over the rest of the room. There was a tool cupboard at the far end. He knew better than to have the knife he was using vanish. Johnny parted his leash, raced to the tool cupboard, and opened it. It was a messy pile of parts, wires, and tools. He rummaged in it frantically. Seconds sped by. Then he saw what he was looking for at the bottom. An old tool of the same kind. From far off, he could feel the rumble of returning feet. He rushed back to his bench and, with the newly found tool, put his leash ends back together again. It worked. Care returned, lazy and disinterested. Johnny had already slid the tool down into the cuff of his moccasin.
You're doing pretty good, said Care, looking at his work.
Yes, I'm doing pretty good, said Johnny.
2. Turl was deep into the puzzle of Numph. Somehow, in some way, Turl knew he had gotten onto something, and then somehow, in some way, he had messed it up. The thing kept him awake nights and gave him a headache. For some of the things he was now going to be seen doing, he had to have the insurance of big leverage on Numph. He had lazied along with the fake mutiny measures. They weren't important anyway. He had caused the few battle planes on the other mine sites to be flown in and parked. He had picked up their arsenals and had them under seal. He had taken over control of the single remaining recon drone. On its last pass over the high mountains, he had gloated. The beautiful vane was still there, naked to view, exposed 100 feet down a 2,000-foot cliff. Pure white quartz studded with wires and knobs of gleaming yellow gold. A fortuitous earthquake had caused the cliff face to shear off and fall into the dark depths of the canyon, exposing the fortune. The ancient volcano higher up must have spewed out a geyser of pure liquid gold in some ancient eruption and then covered it shallowly. A stream had cut the canyon through the ages, and now the slide. The site had a few disadvantages. The approaches to it showed uranium in some form or another, which put it out of bounds for a cyclo. It rested in a cliff face so sheer that it could only be mined from a lowered platform. The rest of 2,000 feet would gape dizzyingly below, and the canyon winds would batter at the mining stage. Room for machinery at the top of the cliff was minimal and precarious. Several miners' lives would be expendable at such a site. Turl only wanted the cream of it. No mining in depth down to the next pocket. Just that pocket right there, the one that was exposed. There must be a ton of gold in sight. At cyclo prices, where very scarce gold ran at very high prices, it was worth nearly 100 million credits. Credits that could bribe and buy and open the doors to unlimited personal power. He knew how to get it out. He had even worked out how to transship it to home planet and get it to arrive there undetected and recoverable. He looked at the recon drone photos again and then falsified their date and place markings with a clever bit of forgery and hid them deep in otherwise innocuous, boring files. To guarantee it, he needed leverage on Numph. Then, in the event of any slip or mishap, he would be protected. There was also the matter of getting his 10-year sentence, he thought of it as a sentence, contracted down to just another year on this cursed planet. Whatever Numph had going involved Nipe and Nipe's home planet post in accounting. Turl had gotten that far. He sat hunched over his desk, thinking. He needed leverage on the animal. And it would have to be big enough to force the animal to dig without supervision and, not only that, to deliver. Well, the animal's learning was going well, and plans for other animals were all in place. He would come up with something. Turl believed in his own luck. The animals somehow would do it, and then he would vaporize them and get the gold to home planet. The unknown was Numph. With a single order, he could dismiss the animals or have them killed. He could simply withdraw permission to use the machinery. And soon, the bumbling old fool, seeing no mutiny, would withdraw the blanket authorizations. The mutiny was too thin. Turl looked at the clock. It was within 2 hours of transshipment time. He got up, took his breathe mask off a peg, and a few minutes later was at the transshipment platform. Turl stood there in the swirling dust and din of pre-shipment time. The dispatch box courier had already been there, and the box, sealed and ready, lay on a corner of the platform. Char came over, interrupted in his preparation for transshipment firing, and unfriendly.
"Routine check of dispatch transmission," said Turl. "Security business."
He showed him the blanket authorization.
"You'll have to be fast," shouted Char, No time to wait around.
He glanced at his clock. Turl scooped up the dispatch box and took it over to the car he had arrived in. He unlocked it with his master key and laid it on the seat. Nobody was watching. Char was back harassing blade machine operators to neaten up the ore. Turl adjusted the button camera on his collar tab and speedily riffled through the sheaves. They were routine reports, routine day-to-day recounting of operational data. Turl had done all this before and it hadn't yielded anything, but there was always hope. The planetary director had to initial everything and sometimes added data and comments. The button camera whirred, and in short order every sheet had been recorded. Turl put them back in the box, locked it, and took it over to the platform.
"Everything all right?" said Char, relieved not to have another detail pushed too close to firing time.
"No personal mail, nothing," said Turl. "When do you send the dead ones back?"
He indicated the morgue.
"Semi-annually, as always," said Char. "Get your car out of here. This is a big shipment and we're in a hurry."
Turl went back to his office. Without really hoping, he put the report copies onto a screen, one after the other, studying them. He was only interested in the ones that had Numph's writing on them. Somehow, somewhere, there was a secret communication in these reports that only Knipe in accounting could decipher. Of that, Turl was certain. There was no other way to get a communication back to home planet. When he finally got this, and when he got a real lever on the animal, he could launch his private mining mission. Turl sat late, missing dinner, studying these and older dispatch box copies until his amber eyes were dulled to a dim flicker. It was here someplace. He was certain of it. 3. Collecting things that would aid his escape was not easy. At first, Johnny had thought he might handle the two button cameras that overlooked his cage, one inside and one outside. If he could bypass these, then at night he could open his collar and freely get about and prepare. He had spent valuable time studying button cameras in the electronics shop. They were simple devices. They had a small mirror to catch the image, and the image became transmitted electrons. The pattern was simply picked up and recorded on a disk. There was no power in the button camera. Power was transmitted to it on a closed circuit from the receiver. He tried to modify his instruction machine to perform the same function. His object was to record a view of the cage with him in it. Then, with a quick switchover, he could leave the button cameras transmitting that picture while he himself was elsewhere. But there were two cameras viewing from different angles. He only had one recorder. Turl caught him one day with the instruction machine in pieces. He was bringing in a rabbit he had shot. The monster stood there for a while and finally said, "Teach an animal a trick, and it has to work it on everything. I think you've wrecked that playing machine." Johnny went on reassembling it. "Put it back together so it works, and you can have this rabbit." Johnny ignored him. But when he had the machine back together, Turl threw down the rabbit.
"Don't monkey with things that don't need fixing," Turl said, with the air of, "Good God, what you have to teach an animal."
But later, Johnny got a break. The problem was body heat detection equipment. If in some way he could nullify such surveillance, then he hoped he could get to the mountains. He doubted he could be traced if the heat-seeking equipment could be fooled. Care had him running a drill into the side of a mine shaft over at the actual mine. It was an abandoned hole about 50 feet in diameter. Care had lowered the drill platform down into the hole. At that point, a rock outcropping was exposed. Under the platform was an ore net. The drill was heavy, having been built for cyclos. Johnny's muscles bulged as he bucked the bit into the outcropping. He had a phone in his ear, and Care was chattering away into it.
"Don't push steady. Just lean on it and let up, time after time. After you got a hole drilled, trip the second trigger, and the drill will expand and break off the ore.
Keep the net in place to catch it as it falls. Now just keep that sequence going.
It's hot, Johnny had yelled back up at him. And it was hot. The drill, spinning at high revs, was heating the wall and in itself was almost glowing with friction.
Oh, said Care. You haven't got a heat protector.
He fished around in his pockets amid papers and bits of old snacks and finally dug out a very small package. He put it in a lowering cup and let it down on a line. Johnny opened it up. It was a sheet of thin, transparent stuff. It had two sleeves.
Put it on, yelled Care.
Johnny was amazed that so much area could be compressed into such a small package. The garment was built for a cyclo, and the sleeves were enormous, and it was much too long. He took some tucks in it and put it on over his head and down the front of his body. He resumed bucking the drill. It was amazing. The reflected heat from the wall and the drill bit did not reach him. After Care finally decided Johnny could use the drill and handle the rig, and Johnny was back on level ground, he went through the motions of giving back the heat shield.
No, no, said Care. Throw it away. It's disposable. They get dirty and torn. A driller usually carries half a dozen. I don't know why I forgot, but I ain't been a driller for years.
It's the only one I got, said Johnny.
And you're sure a driller, said Care.
Johnny neatly repackaged it and put it in his pouch. He was betting that no heat detector could detect through it. If he wore it and kept it from gaping, the spinning scanner would be blind to it, he hoped. The food problem he had solved. The smoked beef was compact and would keep him from starving if he was running so fast that he had no time to hunt. He carefully patched up moccasins and made sure he had an extra pair. Turl observed that, too.
You don't have to wear those, you know,
Turl said one evening as he came out to check the cage locks.
There are old chinko boots that could be cut down. Didn't they give you any boots with your clothes?
The following day, the compound tailor came out, complaining in his breathe mask, and measured Johnny for boots.
I am not a bootmaker, he protested.
But Turl had shown him the blanket requisition, so the tailor also measured Johnny for a heavy knee-length overcoat and cold-weather cap.
It is coming on to summer, said the tailor. It's not the time of year for winter clothing.
But he had done the measuring anyway, and very soon the boots and clothing were delivered to the cage.
Freaky executives, the tailor had muttered during the final try-on, dressing up animals.
It made Johnny uneasy that Turl was being obliging. He carefully checked all his preparations over to see whether he could give away his plans to escape. He decided not. Turl seemed very preoccupied these days, indifferent. Or was that a pose? The thing that was really giving Johnny a problem was how to get his hands on a gun. Before all the mutiny precautions, some of the workers he had seen had worn relatively small, compact handguns at their belts. He had supposed they used them for plinking or shooting game. Turl still wore his, a rather bigger one, but the others seemed to have stopped. Johnny wondered how far he could trust Care. The midget was definitely Turl's creature. But from some of the tales Care had chattered on with, he was distinctly criminal. He told how he had rigged certain games of chance, how he had looted ore boxes as a joke, how he had gotten a female to believe her father needed money and relayed it for her. One day they were waiting for a machine to be idle so it could be used in practice, and Johnny decided to make a test. He still had the two discs he had gotten in the Great Village. He knew now that one was a silvery coin and the other a gold coin. He took the silver coin out of his pocket and began flipping it.
What's that?
Care wanted to know. Johnny gave it to him and Care scratched it with a talon.
I dug some of these up once in a wrecked town on the southern continent, said Care. You must have gotten this locally, though.
Why? Said Johnny, alert that perhaps Kerr could read English letters.
It's fake, said Kerr. An alloy of copper with a nickel-silver plating. A real coin, and I saw some once, is solid silver.
He handed it back, losing interest. Johnny took out the yellow coin and started flipping it. Kerr caught it in the air before it could fall back into Johnny's hand. His interest was sudden and intense.
Hey, where did you get this?
Kerr dented the edge with a talon tip and looked at it closely.
Why?
Said Johnny innocently. Is it worth something?
A very sly look came into Kerr's eye.
The coin he was holding and trying to be casual about was worth 4,000 credits. Gold, alloyed just enough to be used in coinage without undue wear.
Kerr steadied his hand and looked very, very casual. Where'd you get this?
Well, said Johnny, it came from a very dangerous place.
There are more of them?
Kerr was quivering a little bit. He was holding in his paw 3 months' pay, all in one little coin. And as an employee, he could legally possess it as a souvenir. On Cyclo, it could buy a wife. He tried to remember how many coins it took for them to cease to be souvenirs and become company property. 10? 13? So long as they were old and obviously mintage, not some fake made by a miner.
The place is so dangerous one couldn't go there without at least a belt gun.
Kerr looked at him searchingly.
Are you trying to get me to give you a belt gun?
Would I do something like that?
Yes, said Kerr.
This animal was very, very quick on machines. Quicker, in fact, than Cyclo trainees.
Kerr looked longingly at the gold coin or medallion or whatever it had been.
He said nothing. Then he handed it back to Johnny and just sat there, his amber eyes shadowed in the depths of his breathe-gas dome. Johnny took the coin back.
I'm careless with things like this. I can't buy anything, you know. I keep it in a hole just to the right of the cage door as you come in.
Kerr sat there for a while. Then he said,
The next machine is ready.
But that night, while Turl was making his rounds of the mine site and was distant from his viewing screen, the gold coin disappeared from the hole where Johnny had put it, and in the morning, when Johnny dug there, covering the action with his body, a small handgun and spare charges were in the hole instead.
Johnny had a gun.
4. A remaining hurdle was knowledge. The Chinkos were good teachers, and they could stack real learning onto a disk and get it assimilated like lightning flashes. But basically, they had been working for Cyclos, and trying to teach Cyclos, and they omitted a lot of things that Cyclos either already knew or could not have much interest in. This left gaps. Johnny had picked up inferences that there was uranium in the mountains to the west. Mostly he guessed this because no active mining ever seemed to have been undertaken there by the Cyclos. From the accident he had witnessed, and for other reasons, he suspected uranium was deadly to the Cyclos. But he didn't know for sure, and he didn't know how. He was utterly dismayed in studying the text on electronic chemistry to find there were many, many different atomic formations of uranium. Sitting at his fire, grinding away at texts and the instruction machine alternately, Johnny was disturbed by the ground shake that always preceded Turl. It was simply the monster's nightly rounds.
What are you studying so hard, animal?
Asked Turl, looming over him. Johnny decided to plunge, to take a chance. He looked the many feet up to Turl's mask.
It's the mountains to the west, said Johnny.
Turl looked at him suspiciously for a little while. There's not much in here about them, said Johnny. Turl was still suspicious. What had this animal guessed? I was born and raised there, said Johnny. There's data on mountains everywhere else on the planet, but hardly any on those right there. He pointed to where faint moonlight shone on the bold snow caps. The Chinkos took a lot of books out of the library. Man books. Are they here?
Oh, snorted Turl in relief. Man books. Ha!
Turl was rather more pleased than otherwise. This fitted into his own concentrations. He left and came back shortly with a battered table and a disorderly armload of books that avalanched down on it. They were frail books, very ancient, and some broke their backs or came apart with his mishandling.
I am nothing but an animal attendant, said Turl. If mauling through this gibberish makes you happy, be happy.
He paused at the cage door after he went out and locked it.
Just remember one thing, animal. The junk you'll find in those man books didn't have anything in them to defeat Cyclos.
Then he laughed.
Probably lots of recipes on how to prepare raw rat, though.
He rumbled off to the compound, his laughter fading. Johnny touched the books reverently, and then, with hope, he began to inspect them. They mostly concerned mining. His first find was a text on chemistry. It contained a table of elements that gave the atomic formation of every element man had known. With a sudden puzzlement, he grabbed the cyclo text on electronic chemistry. It too had a table on the atomic formation of elements. He put them side by side in the flickering firelight. They were different. Both tables were apparently based on the periodic law, by which the properties of the chemical elements recur periodically when the elements are arranged in increasing order of their atomic numbers. But there were elements on the man table that did not occur on the cyclo table, and the cyclo table had dozens more elements. The cyclo table also had many more gases listed, and did not seem to specialize in oxygen. Johnny floundered through it, not too adept at getting the abbreviations related to the substances, more used to reading cyclo than English. Yes, the cyclos listed radium and even gave it an atomic number of 88, but they noted it as a rare element, and they had dozens of elements numbered and listed above 88. Nothing made it plainer than the difference in these tables that he was dealing with an alien planet in an alien universe. Some of the metals were compatible, but on the whole, the distribution was different, and even atomic formation seemed at variance. At length, he suspected that both tables were imperfect and incomplete, and, with a spinning head, gave it up. He was a man of action, not a chinko. He turned to his next huge question. Were there uranium mines in the mountains? At length, he found some charts and listings. He had been certain that there must be uranium mines, man mines, in those mountains. But all he found were notations that where they had existed, they were mined out. What? No uranium mines? No active ones, anyway. Yet he was dead certain that there must be uranium in those mountains. Otherwise, why would the cyclos avoid them? Maybe they just thought there was. No, there must be uranium in those mountains. Some of his plans began to crumble at the edges, and he fell into something like despair. He began to search in the books, looking for any references at all to uranium. And then he hit, as Care would say, pay dirt of a sort. It was a book on mine toxicology, a subject he made out as Poisons in Mines Affecting Miners. And there it was in the index, Uranium, Radiation Poisoning. For the next half hour, he struggled through the entry. It seemed that you had better damn well be clothed in lead shielding when you fooled around with radium or uranium or radiation. All sorts of terrible things happened if you weren't. Rashes, hair falling out, burns, blood changes. And then he had it. People bombarded with radiation experienced changes in their genes and chromosomes, and birth defects and sterility resulted. That was what was wrong with his people. That was why children seldom came, and why those that did were often imperfect at birth.
That was the reason for the lethargy of some of them. And that could also be the red sickness and the crumbling away of his father's bones. It was all there. It described exactly what was happening to his people. Why they did not multiply. There was radiation in the village valley. He went back hurriedly to the mine maps. No, there was not even a worked-out uranium mine anywhere around the village. But radiation was what it was. The symptoms were unmistakable. He knew now why the cyclos stayed away from there. But if there were no mines, where was the radiation coming from? The sun? No, not that. Goats on the higher ridges had no trouble multiplying, and he had never seen a deformed goat. Well, he had an answer of sorts. It was not a clean-cut one. There was radiation, but no mines. It struck him abruptly that man must have had a way of detecting radiation. He seemed to know so much about it. Eventually, he found that, too. It was called a Geiger counter, after somebody named Geiger, who was born and died on dates that Johnny had no trace or inkling of. It seemed that radiation, or ionizing particles, if present, passed through a gas. The radiation generated a current in the gas that made a needle react. Radiation somehow generated a current in certain gases. The schematic diagrams were unintelligible to him until he found a table that gave the abbreviations. He could then translate them across into cyclo, which he did laboriously. He wondered whether he could make a Geiger counter. He decided, given the cycloelectronics shop, that he could. But after he escaped, that wouldn't be available. Despair began to creep in on him. He finally put the books away and, in the small hours, fell into an exhausted sleep. He had nightmares. Chrissy mauled and smashed to bits. His people wasted and truly extinct. And the world of the cyclos come alive and laughing at him. 5. But it wasn't the whole world of the cyclos laughing. It was Turl. Mid-morning sunlight filled the cage as Johnny awoke. Turl was standing at the second table, turning over the man books and laughing. Johnny sat up in his robes.
You finished with these, animal?
Johnny went over to the artificial pond and washed his face. A month back, he had persuaded Turl to keep a trickle running in so he could get clean water at the intake. It was cold and refreshed him. There was a shattering crash in the air, and for a moment he thought something had blown up. But it was only the recon drone passing overhead. For some days now, it had been making mid-morning sweeps. Care had explained to him what it was. It was an ore detection activity surveillance craft, capable of taking continuous pictures. It was regulated by remote control. All his life, Johnny had seen such craft overhead and had supposed they were natural phenomena, such as meteors or the sun and moon. But those had passed every few days, and this one was passing daily. The old ones did not rumble in the distance as they approached, and did not make an explosion as they went by. This one did. Care hadn't really known why, but it had to do with speed. They were very fast. You couldn't turn one in the air or stop one. You could only guide it, and it had to go all the way around the planet to get back. So this one, if it was the same one, was circling the planet daily. The harsh boom was very unpleasant. Turl looked up at it and then carefully ignored it. Mine site personnel didn't like it.
Why every day? Said Johnny, looking up at it.
It was an element in his escape planning. It only took pictures, but that would be enough.
I said, snarled Turl, are you finished with these books?
The recon drone was fading, its rumble losing itself across the eastern plains. Its path had been from the mountains. Johnny made a breakfast of cold meat and water. Turl stacked the books up in his arms and went to the cage door. Turl halted indifferently.
If you're so keen on data about those mountains, said Turl,
There's a whole relief map of them in the library of that town up north. You want to look at it?
Instantly alert, Johnny nevertheless kept on with his breakfast. An accommodating Turl always had something else in mind. But this was a chance Johnny had scarcely dared hope for. In his planning, he had gone over ways to get Turl to take him out in the car. It would be a simple matter to throw a door catch, swing a blast of air into the car, hit the emergency stop button, and hold a gun on Turl. Desperate, but it was a chance.
I got nothing to do today, said Turl. Your machine training has ended. We might run up to the town, look at that relief map, do a little hunting, maybe look some more for your horse.
A rambling Turl was not within Johnny's experience. Did the monster know something?
I want to show you something anyways, said Turl. So get your things together and I'll be by in about an hour, and we'll take a ride. I've got to check some things. I'll be back. Be ready, animal.
Johnny scrambled. This was a bit premature and it upset his planning, but he looked on it as a heaven-sent chance. He had to get away and get to his people, both to stop Chrissy if she attempted to keep her promise and to move the village to a safer place. There were only 2 weeks left before the constellation returned to its place. He put the small gun in his belt pouch, put the metal cutter alongside his ankle, packed a supply of smoked beef. He dressed in buckskin. When the hour was up, a vehicle rumbled into sight and stopped. Johnny stared at it, wondering what was going on. This was not the Mark III tank. It was a simple equipment truck, normally used for transporting machinery. It had an enclosed, pressurized cab. The back was large and open, surrounded by stakes. Its only similarity to a tank was that it had no wheels, but skimmed a varying distance up to 3 feet above ground. Then Johnny realized that this might work to his advantage. It had no heat seekers, no guns. Turl got out and opened the cage.
Throw your things into the back, animal, and ride in the back.
He unfastened the leash and boosted Johnny over the tailgate. He took out a pocket welder and fastened the leash to the cab.
This way, said Turl, I won't have to smell those hides.
He was laughing when he got into the cab, took off his mask and turned on its system. Suddenly, Johnny realized he had no way of immobilizing Turl. He couldn't open the door on him. The truck skimmed away. It was slower than the tanks, and it was not as well cushioned against the ground, for it was now running very underloaded. Johnny held on, his head ducked below the forward cab level. The 80-mile-an-hour wind of passage roared over his head and against the truck's upright stakes. He was thinking fast. Somehow he could play this so as to get the truck as well. Its controls weren't any different, of that he was certain, from the quick glance he had had. All cyclo controls were simple levers and buttons. What a relief it would be to get rid of this collar. His heart was thudding expectantly. Once again, if he made no mistakes, he would be free. 6. It was no more than 1 o'clock when they thudded to a halt outside the library in the town. Turl got out, shaking the vehicle with his weight. He was still conversational when he unfastened the leash.
See anything of your horse?
Not a thing, said Johnny.
Too bad, animal. This truck is the very thing to carry a horse, or 10 horses, for that matter.
Turl went to the library door and with a tool undid the lock. He gave the leash a yank and sent Johnny in ahead of him. The place was a quiet tomb of dust, the interior the same as Johnny had last seen it. Turl was looking around.
Ha, said Turl, so that's how you got in before.
He was pointing to the disturbed dust under a window and the unchanged impressions of footprints across the floor.
You even put the guard screens back. Well,
he added, looking around.
Let's find data on the Western Mountains.
Johnny was aware of the changes in himself. Those blotches of white he had seen before were signs, very plain and easy to read. He saw that his previous visit had occurred beside the children's section, and that the shelves he had first approached were marked Child Educational.
Wait a minute, said Turl. I don't think you know how to read a library index. Come over here, animal.
He yanked on the leash he had let run long. He was standing by stacks of small drawers. He bent over and opened one.
According to the Chinkos, every book has a card, and the cards are in here in these drawers. Alphabetical. Got it?
Johnny looked at the drawers. Turl had pulled one out that was all Q. The cards were musty and grayed, but readable.
Anything there about mountains? Said Turl.
Tense as he was, Johnny had to repress a smile. Here was more proof that Turl couldn't read English. The drawer you have there is all about vehicles, said Johnny.
Yes, I can see that, said Turl. Go through it and find mountains.
He moved off, elaborately interested in some ancient posters on the wall, holding the leash. Johnny started opening drawers. Some were stuck, others had their front tabs missing. But he finally found the drawers for M. He began to go through the cards. He came to Modern Military Science.
I've found something, said Johnny. May I have a pen to write the numbers?
Turl handed him a pen several sizes too big for Johnny's hand, and then gave him some folded sheets. Turl wandered off again. Johnny wrote down the numbers of several books.
I have to go over to the shelves now, said Johnny, and Turl paid out more line.
After a little while, and after a minor battle with a ladder that had sunk into and stuck to the floor, Johnny got up to a higher shelf and raised the protective sheet. In a moment, he was swiftly scanning through a section of a book headed Defense Systems of the United States.
Anything about mountains? Said Turl.
Johnny bent down and showed him a page entitled MX-1 Anti-Nuclear Silos.
Yep, said Turl.
Johnny handed him the book.
We better take this one. There's some more.
In rapid order, he fought the ladder along the shelves and took out another half-dozen books. Nuclear Physics, Congressional Hearings on Missile Installations, The Scandals of Nuclear Mismanagement, Nuclear Deterrent Strategy, Uranium, Hope or Hell, and Nuclear Waste and Pollution. There were more, but he felt rushed, and the seven books were heavy for a man about to run.
I don't see any pictures, said Turl.
Johnny quickly pushed the ladder along. He grabbed a book, Colorado Scenic Wonderland, glanced at it, and gave it to Turl.
That's more like it, animal.
Turl was pleased with the gorgeous views of mountains, particularly since many were purple and the aging ink had turned bluish.
More like it.
Turl put the books in a sack.
Let's see if we can locate the relief map.
He gave the leash a yank that almost tumbled Johnny off the ladder. But Turl didn't lead the way to another floor right then. He wandered over to the door first and seemed to be listening. Then he came back and went up some stairs. There was a relief map laid out on display, possibly not a permanent fixture. Turl knelt down and looked at it searchingly. Johnny, keyed up as he was made very uneasy by the colored relief map. It showed the nearby mountains very accurately by his estimation. The passes and high peak were plain, and there was the meadow of the village in plain sight. Of course, the map had been made ages before there was a village, but still, there it was. It made Johnny nervous. He knew the recon drone must have spotted it long since, and that Turl undoubtedly had pictures of it. There, also, was the long canyon, and Johnny knew he was looking at the location of what he had taken to be an ancient tomb. He looked as closely as he could without calling it to Turl's attention.
No, there was no tomb or anything else marked at the head of that canyon. As a slight diversion, he traced out with his finger some of the letters. Rocky Mountains, Pike's Peak, Mount Vale. Then he saw that he needn't have bothered to dissemble. Turl's attention was glued on a deep, long canyon. A talon was carefully tracing a cliff face and the river below it. The monster, seeing Johnny was watching, quickly traced some other canyons in the same way. But he came back to that one canyon. Turl stiffened for a moment, head jerking up. Then he became very bland.
Seen all you want, animal.
Johnny was happy to get him away from the relief map. It was too much like Turl staring down at Johnny's people. Turl went down the stairs toward the front door, pools of ancient dust stirring as he walked. The sound of their footsteps had obscured it. Johnny was certain he heard the hoof strike of a horse. 7. Turl was standing just outside the library, looking down the grass-grown street. Johnny shifted his position to see what Turl was looking at. He went rigid with shock. 100 yards away, there was Windsplitter. And somebody on him, and 3 other horses behind him. Turl was just standing there, watching the street. The moment had come. It was not coordinated, but Johnny knew he was having his last chance. He snapped the metal tool out of his ankle cuff and slashed the leash. It parted. Like a streak of light, Johnny sprinted out of the door, past Turl. Suddenly, yanking talons caught in the buckskin. It ripped. Zigzagging like a hare, Johnny headed for the nearest tree cover, momentarily expecting a pistol blast in the back. He halted with his back braced against a broad aspen. It was Chrissy. And not only Chrissy, there was Patty. A sob surged up through Johnny. Chrissy's glad cry rang out. Johnny! Patty yelled with delight. Johnny! Johnny! And Windsplitter started to trot toward him. Go back! Screamed Johnny. Run! Oh my God, run! They halted, perplexed, their gladness turning into alarm. At a distance behind Johnny, they could see a thing. They started to turn the horses. Johnny crouched and whirled. Turl was still standing in the library door. Johnny grabbed the handgun from his pouch and threw the safety off. He let the handgun show. If you fire on them, you're dead, he shouted. Turl just stood there. There was a turmoil of horses behind Johnny. He risked a glance back. Windsplitter had reared. He had seen no reason not to approach his master. He was fighting to come forward. Run, Chrissy, run! Screamed Johnny. Turl was walking forward, rumbling, indolent. He had not drawn his gun.
Tell them to ride up closer, called Turl.
Stand where you are, shouted Johnny. I'll shoot. Turl leisurely strolled forward.
Don't get them hurt, animal.
Johnny stepped out from the tree. The handgun was extended. He was sighting it on Turl's mask tube.
Be reasonable, animal,
said Turl, but he stopped. You knew they would be here today, said Johnny.
Yes, said Turl. I've been tracking them by recon drone for days, ever since they left your village. Put the gun away, animal.
Behind him, Johnny could hear the horses milling. If only they would run. Turl, paw staying clear of his gun, was reaching for his breast pocket. Stay still or I'll shoot, called Johnny.
Well, animal, you can go ahead and pull the firing catch if you like. The electrical connector has a dummy wire in it.
Johnny looked at the gun. He took a deep breath and lined it up. He clenched the trigger. Nothing happened. Turl finished his motion to his breast pocket. He took out the gold coin and tossed it into the air and caught it.
I, not care, sold you the gun, animal.
Johnny pulled a kill club from his belt. He braced himself for a charge. Turl's paw motion was swifter than the eye. His belt gun was out. It fired a sharp bark. An inhuman scream racketed out behind Johnny. He glanced back. A pack horse was down, threshing.
Your friends will be next, said Turl.
Johnny lowered the club.
That's better.